As a boy growing up in Alabama, he dreamed of going to school at Missouri. Really?
What?
I'll be deep in the cold, cold ground before I recognize Missouri.
Okay. Now he covers the Royals. He's Alec Lewis of The Athletic on the program.
Welcome back into the program. Todd Lebo in for Sorin Petro today. Curtis Ebolt alongside Adam Dravetta pushing the buttons. Bobby, I like damn it, Bobby, better than Uncle Rico. The intern is hanging out here learning all about what we do here. It's very fun for him, I'm sure. Now it is time to talk to our good friend Alec Lewis from The Athletic. Hello, Alec. How are you?
Pretty good, Todd. Pretty good. Good to hear from you. Good to hear your voice. I'm actually here in Kansas City. Didn't go on this road trip. Spending some time clearing my head on the 4th, and I'm good.
You shoot some firecrackers off or anything? Did you have some fun? Did you go to a party? What'd you do?
I went to the lake for a few days with some buddies. I'm not a big fireworks guy. Never have been. I don't know why. Maybe my parents weren't big fireworks. I don't know. Never. But I had a good time at the lake. It was very warm, but it was very, very enjoyable to just kind of get away and enjoy the Missouri summer.
Did you get out to with the Ozarks? Is that the lake you were at?
Yeah.
I heard it was a zoo down there. I heard the channel was choppy. Were you on a boat or just chilling?
Just chilling. Hanging out, grilling. You know how it is.
Grilling. Hey, there were enough fireworks down there for you. You didn't have to shoot any of them yourself. My understanding is it started early, 7 a.m. every day.
Exactly. I let the pros do. I mean, they got it handled. I don't need to part my own firework ability on anybody else.
We are going to talk to Alec Lewis about the Royals, but first, I do want to talk to you about, I know this isn't your beat, but you are, you're an SEC man, that's where you're from, and you went to a school that was a Big 12 school and went into the SEC in Missouri, but you're from Birmingham, right? People always pick that up from your accent. That's a joke, you have no accent. But
always.
I've told people... and I've been around these things, and I think I briefly talked to you about this last week. We're at the stadium. I went up to the College World Series last week, and people joke about the tagline. It just means more, whatever. I'm telling you, it does. You grew up down there in Birmingham, and around that area of the country, college athletics, I think in many ways it does just mean more, for better or worse. I don't know. Things just mean more. We're in the midst of one of these deals again with a college realignment where USC and UCLA are moving to the Big Ten. Oklahoma and Texas, it was announced last year, are moving to the SEC. What are your thoughts? What are you hearing from people, your colleagues and stuff like that at The Athletic? I don't think anything will ever end. Do you think we're at a waypoint at some point with this group here? Are we going all the way to monster conferences?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like the geographical culture of college athletics is kind of moving out the window. I mean, the SEC is the SEC, and you're right. I grew up in Birmingham, which for people that don't know, I mean, the SEC is based there. It's smack dab kind of near Alabama and Auburn. And it just means more thing. It's funny, but I mean, really in Alabama, you don't have much more specifically from a cultural pride standpoint, you don't have anything more overwhelming than college football. So I think it means more for a reason. It's a source of pride for people there. And I know that's not speaking specifically to your question, but I just think, I don't know, from like you mentioned, I talked to people who've covered college sports, and I think there's just been so much transition over the last few years with NIL and with the state of amateurism or lack thereof. And so I think there's just been so much fluctuation. It's been fascinating to watch. I can't imagine what it's been like to cover every day. Guys like Pete Thamel and others do that very well, and I enjoy watching them do it, but I can't imagine when you have this type of thing pop up seemingly monthly, yearly. It's an interesting thing that I don't know. I'm fascinated. I've thought about this for a couple of years now. Obviously, I'm from where I'm from. The SEC was what it was growing up, and I'm fascinated to see, 5, 10 years, what this looks like. I mean, I've thought for a long time, my the realm of college sports and when my kids are growing up compared to when I grew up, I think it's just going to be so holistically different. That'll be really interesting to contrast.
Yeah, it's basically like a trading deadline every day, kind of. It's what it's like. That's what it feels like, because you see these reports that come out about this school going here and this school going there, and you know, kind of how it goes, and you don't know what's true and what's not true and where it'll end up, because the things just change like almost hourly. And we went through this big time, you know, 12 years ago when it all, we kind of had a pretty good stretch of time without much going on. You know, like Penn State joined the Big Ten, and that was kind of what happened. And then a couple of teams got into the SEC in the early 90s, and Arkansas and what the people over there will call you the real USC, South Carolina. And then it just kind of all went for a bit, and we had like 15 years with nothing. And now it's just like, it seems like it's happening more and more often. So I don't know. People want to know when it ends. I don't think it ends, because I think it's going to just continue. But I think we are looking, obviously, conferences are bigger. The SEC used to be a small conference. The Big Eight was a small conference. The Big Ten had 10 schools in it. The ACC was small. You know, the Big East was the Big East. There was something called the Metro Conference. That's what Florida State used to be in, right? I mean, there were all these things that were smaller, and it's just kind of getting bigger now. And I don't know where the bigness will end, but I do know this. Like, even in the SEC, we've lost all semblance of a real cohesive unit of a conference, because you will go 6-7 years without playing someone in football. And that doesn't feel like a conference to me. You know what I mean?
It's fascinating. Like, Missouri plays at Auburn this year, and then I think they will go, gosh, I think 12 years or so without playing at Auburn again. And that may even elongate, given, obviously, as you mentioned, the addition of Oklahoma and Texas. And, I waffle back and forth. Like, there's part of me that I think when I'm older will long for the 12-team, 14-team SEC. And then I think, I don't know, part of me also thinks it's pretty cool that Alabama can play Texas however often basis. So I don't know. There's just so much money involved, and the political type of operation behind conference realignment is again, like, it's why I'm kind of fortunate to watch it from the sidelines as opposed to be in it covering it, because I can't imagine the machinations of what it looks like on a daily basis.
Well, I know the SEC media days and Big 12 media days and Big 10 media days will be fun. Those would be wild. It's a big scene.
No doubt.
So that'll be fun. All right, Alec Lewis from The Athletic is our guest. We will talk some Royals now. I'm going to talk to you about something that was not on the field that happened on Sunday. And I know Curtis watched this, and I did not. The game was on Peacock without announcers. And this is kind of like the way that baseball is doing some things, right? I mean, there's Bally's for the Royals. You can pay your monthly fee for that now. We've had a game on YouTube. They've had a game on Apple TV on a Friday night. They've had a game on Peacock. While you were at the lake, did you watch the Peacock game? Or what are your thoughts about where these things may be heading with baseball?
Yeah, I didn't watch the game. Did not watch the Peacock game. But I was thinking about this last night, because it's July 4th, and I was listening to some people talk ahead of July 4th dinner with friends. They were talking about, like, most of these other sports have these days of the year that are kind of like their day. I mean, obviously the NFL on Thanksgiving, I mean, college football on New Year's, the NBA has Christmas, and baseball obviously has opening day. But I don't know, I was like starting to think a little bit, like, why doesn't baseball kind of like have some kind of headline type matchup each July 4th or all day on one network? I don't know. It's something I was thinking about yesterday, and maybe that's a crazy thing to think about. But I think part of the reason I've thought about it is because, I mean, you know, as I talk to people who are my age and even older people who used to love baseball and maybe don't love it as much, I mean, I've thought a lot about just what baseball's place in the psyche of the common person in this country is and has been and will become. And I think the networks and where these games are televised and how they are streamed, I think, plays a big factor in continuing to have this sport be in the psyche of people. And I think that's important for the future health of it. And so, I think the Peacock thing is interesting. I don't know. I tend to believe that the announcers, kind of really good announcers, can enhance the viewing experience. I think there's such value there. But I also, I mean, I think it's like the Manning cast, certain things that have stretched the boundary of what we've known about how games are televised and streamed, I think is a good thing, because I don't know. I think anything that pushes the boundary of what we've known, it could lead to something. And maybe it doesn't, but why not try?
I thought it was something to just generate some viewership for a game that probably wasn't going to have much viewership. People tuned in to see what it was like. Most people, I think, who tuned into that game did so out of just curiosity. Or let me say, people who wouldn't have normally been watching the game decided to watch that game. There were a few that just went, I want to see what this is about. And I don't think they would do it again. I think if the next game was the exact same way, I think the people who tuned in to see it would probably not be tuning back in to see it. So they probably got a handful of eyeballs on that. But I didn't like the way it was executed on a number of fronts. One, I mean, just a basic situation. They didn't have the PA announcer's mic needs to be into the mix, or at least have a microphone in front of it where you can actually hear it. We don't have announcers, but we kind of do. We have people come on and, you know, coming out of breaks and saying things. And now back to silence. And now back to, you know, the ambient noise of the game. And two, if you're going to have a stream that is going to be the only way that fans in both cities can watch the game, it has to be a neutral broadcast. And to have the Tigers crew, essentially, doing the game was just silly. And they had one segment where they came back from break and they were talking about the new fancy foods at Comerica Park that you can get. This crazy burger and this crazy hot dog and this. And they're having, what is happening here? As a Royal fan, why am I watching this? This has nothing to do with me. It has nothing for me. So I think it was interesting, maybe, but I can't imagine anybody else would watch that situation again, and it'll probably go the same way that the announcerless football game did for NBC 42 years ago. They had a Dolphins Jets game at the end, had no announcers, and it never did it again. So I doubt you'll see this again.
Well, what they need to do is they got to have ways to engage someone to watch the game. Because I think the reason there's like no day that baseball owns or whatever is there's just too many games. I mean, they basically own every day this time of year. But when you have that much saturation, it's not special. And by the way, the NFL is about to own Christmas. By the way, you know, they got three games on Christmas
for the
year,
first time ever.
And they had Christmas games last year and they killed the NBA on Christmas. Yeah. So, and the only thing that moves the college football playoff off New Year's Day and the Rose Bowl off New Year's Day is the freaking NFL. So they own that day too. The NFL,
if the NFL
wanted to have a combine on July 4th, they would own July 4th.
Yes.
It's just 100%. The world we're living 100%. In right now.
No, the NFL is obviously a different beast. And I mean, comparing anything, like to your point, to the NFL is just, it's absurd. But no, I mean, I think baseball, you're right, Todd, in that I think the saturation, given the 162-game season, I think it matters. I also think, I mean, like, you see a starting pitcher every 5 days, and nowadays they're pitching less than ever. And so there's just a lot of, I mean, it gets into such a broad conversation about the sport itself. And for as much and as tedious as that conversation could become, I really hope the people in charge and those who have so much more power and say and influence than I do are having the conversations, because I it is kind of jarring when I'm having conversations with a lot of the people that I'm friends with, or people in my age or people that I know, and they're just so disinterested in general. And again, it just can be a little jarring, and maybe it's just so polarizing considering how much I am into it every day, but. I don't know. Broad conversation, very interesting. Curtis was very diplomatic when he said the broadcast was interesting. You could tell he didn't care for it.
It was purely out of curiosity that I watched it.
And well, I tried to log in out of curiosity, and I don't pay for Peacock, so I was immediately rebuffed, and I did not get to watch any of it.
It was worth. I threw the $5 down. And thought, well, let me watch a couple of innings, so I'll know what I'm talking about. And I got two or three innings through, and I went, all I need to see of that mess
The thing I would have tuned in, and again, I was at the lake, but I would have tuned in had Matt Peacock pitched and Brad Peacock been called up.
It would have been a big one.
On Peacock, I would have been locked in.
We could have had Elvis Peacock.
Yeah, that's true.
Right, right. But otherwise, yeah, it was an appointment viewing on my Sunday, July 4th weekend.
Speaking of Elvis Peacock, we have some college recruiting news. Breaking: Avery Johnson, the dual-threat quarterback out of Mays, Kansas, has committed to Kansas State.
Mm-hmm.
Big gets for Chris Klieman and
yes.
K-State. They've gotten one of the best running backs from the state in Derby, Kansas, about 10 days ago, and now the best quarterback. The number one and number three rated players by most services in Kansas are staying home. This kid had offers from like 24 schools, visited a lot of places, even including a visit to two visits to Notre Dame, and had visited Kansas, and Missouri, K-State, and Arkansas, and has picked K-State.
And it was down to three potential Big 12 schools at the end. It was K-State, Washington, and Oregon.
All the Big 12 schools.
eventually.
We're in on it. Let's talk a little bit about what's happening on the field with the Royals right now, Alec. The disappointing part for the Royals has been, I've said this all along, when they get pitching, the bullpen fails. When they don't get pitching, the bullpen is stressed. Not enough timely hitting, and that just kind of showed, especially yesterday. You know, they got a lead against a really quality team, and you just feel like the pen was not going to be able to hold this when it didn't happen. You can kind of see it coming. You get the feel sometimes that these are the way they're going to go for this team. They can't seem to get out of their own way, and there's no real solution for this in the middle of the year here, right? Other than, hey, start pitching 7 or 8 innings out of your starters, and that's not going to happen.
No, I mean, I've compared, going back to April, I think I compared it. It's like the novice golfer goes out, and one day their driver's on, but they can't hit their irons, and they can't putt. And the next day they go out, and they're putting like Jordan Spieth in his prime, and they can't hit a drive, and they can't hit an iron. And that's just, I mean, the reality is teams that aren't very good are not very consistent in any capacity time and time again. And this team is 20 games under 500. They're still on pace for 100 losses. The roster, though they have added young talent and the names of Bobby Witt Jr. and MJ Melendez and Vinny Pasquantino, is still in a spot where the young pitchers have kind of gone back and forth in terms of their success rates. And the bullpen, which the club was hoping would be a strength of the team, has not been at all. And so here we sit. The trade deadline's in about a month, and that is the target we will be looking forward to seeing what they do in this next span.
Well, I think the encouraging thing was last week they did actually make a trade. They, one of the first trades of the year, right? They didn't wait. I mean, I think they did right because Carlos Santana, I didn't look yesterday, but he hasn't exactly been tearing it up.
2-for-2 with 3 walks.
Okay, so he had a big day yesterday. Other than that, he was batting about 108 or 083 or something before that. So they got something for him. Now, next up, what sort of move are we talking about here? I mean, Andrew Benintendi is someone who they don't have under long-term contract. There are other people who are they
smoking the ball right now.
Do they feel that Benintendi is going to be part of the future of this team, or should they get something for him? Have you gotten a feel yet for kind of how this is going to go over the next few weeks as the trade deadline approaches?
Yeah, I think Andrew Benintendi is 100% a player who will be moved for considerable value. I mean, he's a left fielder. His number metrics defensively don't grade off the charts, but as Curtis just said, I mean, he's been without a doubt, without question, the Royals' most consistent hitter this season. He's still 27 years old to be a free agent at the end of the season. And so other teams are and will continue to be very interested in his services. And so I think he's an obvious trade candidate. I mean, the Royals have a lot of players who would garner value. I mean, I can name them off: Whit Merrifield, Scott Barlow, Michael A. Taylor, Brad Keller, Zach Greinke, could go on. But really and ultimately, it's going to be contingent, I'm sure, on how close the Royals view they are. Will they choose to part with the guy they have control of, like Scott Barlow, if they think they have a chance at competing next season. Those are the questions I'm sure they're weighing alongside the offers that other teams will be willing to send over. I mean, I always think it's funny. Like, we evaluate the trade deadline. We evaluate trades. And rarely do we as fans have the most important piece of the trade, and that is what the other team is willing to offer. So we continue to evaluate and see, and ultimately we'll see kind of if the Royals depart from the way they've operated in years past in the form of trading guys with controllable years who would be helpful to contending teams and trade them now.
I don't know that they've had a more valuable trade piece in recent, I can think of, in recent years than where Benintendi is right now. And this trading a big name has not generally been Dayton Moore's strong suit in his tenure. I know they traded Jorge Soler a year ago, but he wouldn't have it the kind of year Benintendi's having now. Moustakas, and I think 18 was traded late, but before that, you have to go back to, I think, Jonathan Broxton to find a guy who was had any impact on the team that was traded
at the deadline.
Yeah, deadline moves. And so if they don't trade Andrew Benintendi, then the only other possibility would be to re-sign him, right? To sign him to a new deal. You can't not trade him and then let him go in the offseason, right?
No, 100%. I mean, I think the re-signing, I mean, like I said, he's 27 years old. He put together a pretty solid season last year, won the Gold Glove, and his at-the-plate production mirrored some of his better years. And then this year, like we've said, has been really, really good. So I think he's due for a pretty large payday this offseason. His agent, Casey Close, I would imagine at this point the team, if the Royals were to have been interested in an extension, I'm sure they would have kicked around those numbers. But I think, to your point, Curtis, I mean, right now with where this team is, 20 games under 500, it would make zero sense for them to keep Andrew Benintendi without extending him long term.
And Taylor's kind of a poor man's Benintendi because he does have some of the same pedigree. He plays a premium outfield spot, has a Gold Glove, has played on a championship team, and is kind of hitting again. I mean, he's gotten fairly hot over the last couple of weeks, hitting about .350, I think, over the last 10 or 12 games. So he doesn't quite have the bona fides that Benintendi does, but I'd imagine they could move Taylor for something not significant, but something at least decent.
No doubt about it. And he's only owed, I believe, $4.5 million next season, and you have control of him. I mean, think about a team like, for example, I'm just throwing this out there, like the Los Angeles Dodgers, to be able to shore up their outfield late in games, to have a guy like Michael A. Taylor to be able to do that would be very beneficial. And, I mean, look, I think I've talked about this, and when you take a guy like Andrew Benintendi and package him with a bullpen arm like Scott Barlow, I mean, I think you're talking about high-level prospect return. But, again, as I said earlier, it's a matter of, in this day and age where teams are more calculated in terms of how they view and expend their assets than ever, how willing will opposing teams be to part with high-level talent, we'll see. But I think you're right in terms of what you've said, Curtis, that the Royals do have a player like Andrew Benintendi who will bring back considerable value, and I don't think he's the only one if the interest is mutual on both sides, that the Royals want to part with talent and other teams seek it.
Well, you just have to ask for stuff. I mean, who cares if they say no? Ask for more than you think they're worth. That's what asking for trades is. You know, I know those things happen all the time. Maybe you don't want it out. You're asking for too much. Who gives a rip? Go ask for something. You don't know if they're going to say no. That's the dance that happens when you're looking for a trade. That the Royals can't be afraid to shop. I mean, they just have to. They have to do it now.
Yeah, and I don't think they are. I mean, it was interesting. I wrote today kind of a primer on what the Royals could do, and there was a quote in there from after the Royals traded Carlos Santana, and J.J. Piccolo said something to the effect of shopping. And I think mostly in that quote he was probably referencing, like, they don't reach out to media members and float offers and rumors and what have you, rather than we don't seek trades. But I don't know. There's a lot of ins and outs of trade deadline and trade packaging that I don't think the average fan or even media member kind of sees in terms of process and how things filter themselves out. But I think you're right, Todd. I mean, look, the Royals, over the last few years have had opportunities to trade controllable talent to contending teams willing to part with high-level prospects. And I think in certain instances they haven't done it because they thought they've been close to contention. And here we sit. They're on pace to lose 100 games. And so I think this could provide another opportunity to depart from how they've operated in years past.
Yeah, the seed has been sown. They're not going to make the playoffs this year. There's no – I mean, you'd have to have some insane scenario, which don't go find it because it's probably happened somewhere. But don't tell the Royals about it because they'll hold out for it. Alec Lewis, hold on the line for us. We'll come back and talk a little more Royals with Alec.
Before Julio Rodriguez of the Mariners, who was the last rookie with 15 homers and 15 steals by the All-Star break? He played center field on back-to-back world champion teams. But not this wasn't not the team he did this for. He wasn't a rookie with the team he went on to win two titles with.
It smells like he played for the Soriano thing
he
something.
He did it for the Angels.
Ooh.
As a rookie, then won back-to-back titles with another team. Played center field.
Man.
Fred Lynn. No.
His rookie year was 87.
Is Erstead or one of those or?
Devon
White. Yeah, he was good, man.
He had 20 steals and 17 homers. He also, I think, he won 7 Gold Gloves, a 3-time All-Star. This guy's the 5th Mariner to do it. At rookie or not, the first.
Ken Griffey involved.
Former Royal, who became the Mariners' first pick in the expansion draft, Rupert Jones.
Oh, old Rupert Jones.
Who was a teammate?
Yeah.
Who was a teammate of Devon White on the '86 Angels?
That should have gone to the World Series.
Yes. In fact, that crazy game where. Yeah. Henderson hit the home run. The Angels tied the game in the bottom of the 9th inning.
Mm-hmm.
The tying run was scored by Rupert Jones, who was a pinch runner.
Rupert Jones.
Rupert Jones.
Who knew you were going to hear that Mariner. Today, Alec Lewis?
And now you have the rest of the story.
Yeah.
Right. But I will tell you, I love watching Julio Rodriguez play. I mean, baseball and watching like the Seattle Mariners, I don't know how common that is for people here, but really talented player. People here get to watch Bobby Witt Jr. every day, so they get to see a young talent that is extremely special. But Julio is another one of those guys. Really fun guy to watch.
Is he the one that hit the 800-foot home run yesterday?
Yes, he hit it to the third deck in San Diego.
I really couldn't see the ball come down. I guess it was the third deck. I almost was looking like it went like even above. It was wild, man.
Yeah, he hammered that ball.
That was crazy. That's absolutely crazy. All right, well, let's talk about some of the young players for the Royals. The Royals Twitter world got its wish last week, right? Carlos Santana gone, Vinny Pasquantino up. It's been, not the greatest first week ever, but he's hit a homer. He's gotten on base a whole bunch. What are your thoughts of the first week of Vinny ball here with the Royals?
Yeah, pretty much what I would have expected. I mean, he puts together really, really good at bats. He hits the ball hard. He's just very smart in the box. And, yes, he's a lumbering-type body. But, I said this last week, I think, when we spoke with Sarin. It's just like he doesn't look lumbering in the box because of just how, I think, prepared he is when he steps in. And just his movements are just really quick. I don't know. The Royals, I saw a stat today that I think – in the last month or so, they're in the top half in the American League in walks from an offensive perspective. And I think a lot of credit has to go to Alex Zumwalt, who has obviously been put in charge this year of the hitting at the big league level after Terry Bradshaw was fired. And I think a lot of credit goes to these young guys who have stepped into the big leagues with this different type of pregame prep and approach that I think we're seeing it on a daily basis.
Yeah, it's been
it's
month
one of the
and
weirder
half,
slash lines you've seen for anyone at any point in the year. 176, 417, 353,
yeah.
770.
Yeah, just thinking he got some hits.
He's got 6 walks and 3 hits in 7.
You know, if you take away his first game where he was just so amped up and he was swinging at the first pitch, he seemed like he was a little out of what he does that first day. The numbers could be even better, but you mentioned
500 OBP since then.
Alex Zumwalt and the change, and that's one of the things that I think as I recall, I can't remember who said it, if it was Dayton or if it was JJ or whatever, or it was Mike. I don't remember who it was on the day we were all out there for the firing and the news, mm-hmm. right? It was like, it's maybe not something you'll see, because it was someone, I think they were maybe talking to Annie. It was like, you're out here every day. You see this, you're out here for early BP. You'll see something different. So, what are they doing that's different that has been out there? Because I've been out there a few times. I've seen some of this offset BP, but I think they've been doing that for a while, but we haven't seen it on the field. Offset BP, for those listening, instead of standing right in front of, you know, putting a little L-shaped cage up and they're 50 feet away or 45 feet away, they go off to about a 45-degree angle. So the batter stands just like he would be, and they're throwing BP from like a 45-degree angle. Mm-hmm. On either side, right? They'll move the cage around. Is that one of the things that's different?
Yeah, no doubt. And people, I mean, I didn't really know what that drill was for. I asked. It's a drill that's been utilized, I think, within baseball for a long time. But essentially, when you throw a pitch from that type of 45-degree angle, it is essentially like where a second base would charge a ball. Like that's they're throwing batting practice from that angle because the hitter has a less amount of time to get their barrel in the zone and connect with the pitch in the zone. So when you're practicing from that type of angle and then it goes back to real time, pitching from the mound straight in front, the hitter kind of, I mean, it's almost like in some ways like using a donut to feel like you're swinging the bat faster, but it kind of like for a cognitive hand-eye coordination strategy to feel like you have more time to get the barrel through the zone. It's one of the, like you mentioned, Todd, multiple things they're doing before the game. And one of the other ones, when they face the Twins, have guys who love to throw fastballs up in the zone, and the Astros do as well. And so what the Royals will do now, they'll have a pitching machine, it's almost like it's throwing pitches from the ground, and the arc of the ball is really traveling straight up. So it's the hitters have to kind of catch the ball out front, and it simulates the pitcher that they're going to face that night. And that's what they're doing a lot of, and they've done it in the minor leagues now for multiple years. But if they're facing a guy with a high release height and a slider, they'll alternate with two different machines. They'll throw, like, a fastball from that release height and then throw a ball in the different machine to simulate a slider. And it's just a lot of pregame prep to simulate what they're going to face in the game. I mean, Alex Zumwalt, though, is also, I mean, he was an advanced scout during the years the Royals obviously won and competed in the two World Series. And so he picks, I don't have some strict examples for you right now, but he picks stuff up about opposing pitchers and what they're relying on in game that I think helps guys as well. And again, you said it. I mean, the production early on, not sure if we saw such a quick adjustment, and obviously not every guy is hitting and batting 300 with a 500 OBP, but I just think overall the types of bats we're seeing is just a completely different level than what we saw at the beginning of the year.
And buy-in is the most important part for any coach, right?
Especially if you're
coming in the middle of the year. Now, they all know who the guy is, right? I mean, not all, but most of the guys knew who he was and maybe had heard some of the ideas because he's not new to the organization. But every single player is different. They go about it differently. Have you heard good things about the buy-in from, generally speaking, the clubhouse?
Yeah, unquestionably. And that's one of Alex Zumwalt's strengths. I mean, I remember, and this could be something I write at some point, but I remember sitting in a suite with Dayton Moore in 2019 at the winter meetings in San Diego, and the Royals had just reshaped their pitching and hitting development, and they decided to go with Alex Zumwalt on the hitting side. And Dayton said, Alex Zumwalt could literally do anything in this organization and do it well. And they obviously put him in charge of hitting. He's been helped by guys like Drew Saylor and Keone Duran. And the players, I mean, he's got great relationships with players, guys like Bobby Witt Jr., guys like Vinny. He's gotten to know very well on an intimate basis through the alternate site and through time spent throughout the minor leagues. And I think the buy-in definitely exists, and it was interesting. I talked to George Brett, who obviously was kind of implemented as a hitting coach years ago, and that's the one thing. He's like, to make any impact as a coach, you have to have the trust of the player. And obviously, these guys are big league talents. They don't get there randomly. They have the type of feel for their swing and opposing pitchers, but they do need guidance along the way and smart and sharp eyes kind of looking to assess what they're doing on a daily basis and what they look like. And I think Alex Zumwalt, it's just been a nice transition given the relationships he had and just how he operates on a daily basis. Very personable guy.
Yeah, that helps for sure. And, you know, results help buy in for players as well. And if they start seeing some stuff, they don't get in their own heads and try to get through there, maybe there'll be a light at the end of the tunnel. The tough part is, I mean, the year is what the year is. I mean, they've had a nice couple of weeks, sort of, you know, despite the couple of devastating losses they've had. It's been better than before because they're only pacing for 101.8 losses now instead of 110. But it's still, it's not where they want to be, obviously. And one of the things, whenever I go out there, I generally try not to get too nuts and bolts with guys. I just try to get a feel for, you know, kind of how they're doing. What's the overall feel of the team? Is Matheny seeing what he wants to see? And are things going that way? And I get the feeling it's okay. I mean, they're down, right? He'll generally answer, yeah, they're down. They're wearing these losses hard. But I haven't seen, like, give up and quit. And that's the important part with any sort of a team sport, right?
Yeah, I don't think there's been any give up and quit, but I strongly do think I've seen just an immense, like, frustration / this is happening again. We came in with some expectations. We talked about wanting to win, and now for the third or so year in a row, it's just kind of same old, same old. And so I think you've seen that. I think you've seen kind of, in some ways, like, some withdrawing from the fact that, like, I mean, okay, we've talked about this and talked about this and talked about this, and yet here we are again. And so, I mean, the reality is there aren't guys in that clubhouse who are going to be throwing stuff and screaming at people. It's just not the type of guys that the Royals have right now on their 26-man roster. But I do think in general, I mean, there have been a lot of days and a lot of mornings, and I've said this on these airways a lot, where you walk in there and it is really quiet, kind of like, there are times where it's like mirrors a library, guys scrolling their phones, and I get it because they're losing and have lost for as much as they have, but it's just kind of tough to see when you see it year after year. And I can't imagine for the guys who have been in it. I mean, I can't imagine because I talk to them a lot, but I can imagine that it's just kind of it sucks the life out of you in some way when I mean, these guys are as competitive as they come. They're professional athletes, and they continue to be holes throughout a team year after year. And this year, it's obviously started the hitting kind of, I mean, it was what it was, and the pitching was what it was as well and remains what it was. Yeah,
the everyday construction of baseball is both a blessing and a curse. When you're winning, it's great. You can't wait to get to the yard. And when you're struggling like that, they have been, it's like, I'm sure – on the drive in, as soon as they see the stadium, it's like, here we go. And it's hard to balance what you'd like out of a player. I mean, if they didn't care, you'd say, well, we've heard about the attitude among the players and that they're really down. But you kind of want some of that, but you don't want too much of that. You don't want the hopelessness, but you also want the seriousness. I'm kind of struggling to figure out how to express that, because it's a very delicate balance. If they were having a great time, the fans would be like, they don't even care if they're losing. But if they are really down about it, you know, it's easy to say, well, gosh, they're clearly down and they've just given up. I mean, it's hard to find that balance when you play six games a week and you lose four of them.
Yeah, you're 100% right. I mean, it's hard to describe like what you would like to see in the ideal psychology of a player on a daily basis when a team is losing this much. And, I mean, tangentially related to that is, I mean, over the past, I don't know, month and a half, 2 months, it seems like almost daily or weekly there's certain things that fans pick up on or are frustrated about, and they see a story and they react strongly. And it's, I mean, I thought about it, like, I have had conversations with people of other teams, like teams that are succeeding, you think everything's great. You think all their coaches are great, their player development is great, their scouting processes are great, and they really might not be. They just might be winning on a day-to-day. And I'm not saying this to say that the Royals, everything is great, because by no means is it. But it's an interesting time when a team loses as much as this team has this year and in years past. it just kind of lends itself to taking on a life of its own, and I think that's what we've seen oftentimes this year.
Yeah, it's a tough spot to be in. I feel bad for you guys going out there covering every night. It's rough. That's why we limit our exposures. We don't make anyone do it every day because it can wear on you too. I mean, because if it's not fun to cover a team that's not having fun, it's just bad news all around. All right, Alec Lewis is our guest, and we're going to go ahead and do a Final Four here. I don't know if Seren always does a Final Four with you, but I want to do a Final Four with you. Okay, are you ready for a Final Four?
Sometimes Seren does it, but he's me. So I thank you for doing it.
We're going to do a fun Final Four here with Alec Lewis, brought to you by the University of Kansas Health System. What was the first college football game you ever went to?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that's a really, really good question. One of the earliest memories I have is I remember going to Alabama-Louisiana Monroe football game. This might have been Saban's first year.
Oh, they lost. Didn't they lose?
I think they lost. Oof. That game. There's some stuff that blends in my head. There was a Florida International game. I think Ty Hilton.
T.Y. Hilton?
A kickback.
Oh, yeah.
Hilton. I don't know why I just said Ty Hilton. T.Y. Hilton. They run a kickback. And then there's a Duke game, Duke, Alabama, that I remember going to at Bryant Denny, and I remember our car got towed after the game. So those are like three things that just flashbulb through my head. But I've been to a lot of games, so could be forgetting something.
All right. The Yankees have 58 wins. When will the Royals win their 58th game?
September.
Like 1st or 30th?
No, not 30th. Like maybe 3rd.
You're going to get them hot then. All right.
By the way, at some point, that number is going to be somewhere where the date is going to be next
there.
Year.
Yeah, it will be next year.
April 15th.
It keeps – sometimes it's better, sometimes it's worse. All right. What did you guys grill this weekend?
Just some burgers and hot dogs, nothing crazy. I had a ribeye.
Had a steak, yeah. Huh? Did you medium yeah. Well, medium rare?
Medium-ish. Medium, I can go medium rare. I grew up doing medium well, and I know people are going to probably hate that I said that. But
with
that's
ketchup
my
on them?
Ugh. Literally not my choice. Not a ketchup. Not a Mahomes. I'm not cool. I'm not as cool as Mahomes. I can't get away with it.
All right, and finally, you went to Mizzou.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure you went to all the basketball games.
I actually covered the basketball team all 4 years.
There you go. Antlers, love them or hate them?
Well, I'm definitely not going to say I hate them because then I'll get crushed on Twitter. I think they provide something different. I'll probably leave it at that. They have their niche, and anybody who has their niche, I'll be okay with that.
Did you hear that, Antlers? Leave Alec Lewis alone. He's a friend. Not an enemy, he's a friend.
Don't throw bottles of urine at him.
No, leave him alone. He's a good man. Alec Lewis, thanks for your time, buddy. We'll talk Royals again soon, okay?
Of course. Thank you, guys. Be good. Enjoy the rest.
Welcome back into the program. Todd Lebo in for Seren Petro. He's on his way to Lake Tahoe with the crew, Stephen St. John. Ben Messner, our production manager, doing some video work out there. Big boss man, Chad Boger. American Century Championships coverage starts tomorrow, and Seren will be live from there, I think from the driving range, hopefully. It's going to be different this year. We haven't done Tahoe in a couple of years, and they've changed things. They're not inviting like the number of radio stations they used to. I think we're the only one who's going to be there. So it'll be a little different setup, but they'll be out there with that. It's a great event. It's beautiful Lake Tahoe. As you said, Curtis.
Yes, always.
It's a wonderful place and a really cool event that American Century puts on. We're very proud to be a part of it. So they will be out there tomorrow, and we're saying tomorrow is Wednesday. That's what we're saying, and today is definitely Tuesday. So we'll have a few days of coverage of that, which will be fun, and you can always watch that great event on the NBC family of networks. You can see some great golf and some other golf. That's basically what that.
Some great golf and some golf.
Yeah. You see some great golf and Charles Barkley playing as well.
And just some of the other guys aren't that great either. And we've already had a bunch of fun interviews on from folks who are going to be out there playing in it because it really is really cool.
Wells and Thielen are both on the podcast, and I'm telling you that for anybody listening, that those were fun. Those guys have a lot of personality. So I would encourage anybody to check those out on the podcast.
Very cool. Tom Glavine was on with us on the Border Patrol. I was in he for was Steven terrific. Last week. He was great, you know, talking pitching and all that. Very gracious with his time. So he's a good golfer, not the best of the Braves. Smoltz is usually mm-hmm. – Smoltz can win this thing out there. He's good.
Yeah, you hear people say, well, why are pitchers such good – well, they get you know, days off. But I don't think that's what it is. Because kickers are that way too. Which is a pretty direct cause and effect relationship with why those guys, Zach Greinke called it the touch gene,
mm-hmm.
and those guys have that. They're good at looking at a target, aiming for it, and knowing exactly how to put a ball where it's supposed to be, and that's what golf is at its essence. So why wouldn't a guy who's a good control pitcher who can consistently take a baseball and throw it 60 feet 6 inches into a box?
Helps to have the time.
It does help to help have the time, but, you know, there's guys who have a lot of time.
Oh, that, yeah. They have to want to do it. And if you've made the major leagues and you've gotten to the perfection that those really, we were talking about the Braves pitchers, the Hall of Fame pitchers they had there, and you're going to be good at probably whatever you try athletically. They could probably all really shoot free throws or what. I mean, you know, all of those things.
There is something to that.
There is something definitely to that. So those will happen. And I do want to remind you, midnight tonight, voting for the honorary ESPYs ends. You can do that online at 810WHB.com. Mm-hmm. If you've got, we've already got the, you know, the categories are picked and the finalists are there. You can do your voting online at 810WHB.com till midnight tonight. That's our time, not Tahoe time. Midnight tonight, get your votes in. And I want to remind you, this happened while we were on the air with Alec Lewis. Big recruiting get for Chris Klieman in K-State as Avery Johnson, who is a Mays High School four-star quarterback. He's got a year to go.
Number Mays, 12 QB in the country.
Mays is, it's corn. It's actually near Wichita is what it is. It's on the outskirts there. So that's a couple of.
Over in Wesson County.
Derby is where the running back kid was from, and those are all in and around the Wichita area. These are big gets for Chris Klieman. That's the number one and number three players by most services in the state who are going to go to school at K-State. The number two player, very famous name, John Randall. Mm-hmm. John Randall Jr., the Kansas running back, who's a very good collegiate player. His son is not committed yet, but I think a lot of people think that Kansas has an inside track there, but it's recruiting, right? And the commitment here from Avery Johnson is a commitment. It's not a signing, but it's step one in the process. This is he picked... he was recruited by a lot of schools, had a lot of offers from a lot of places. This is a big recruit for Kansas State and Chris Klieman.
Oregon, you beat Oregon for a guy. Even though he's in your state, that's still an accomplishment. And
as I said, he visits to Notre Dame and Arkansas and all those things. So
K-State fans were all a Twitter, not literally. About this, and it seemed like it was going that direction. But you know, you're always kind of nervous as a fan of a school who occasionally has had, we're supposed to get this guy, but what happens if they don't? And when you finally see that cat's hat go up, you're good.
Real quick, it would appear this has, according to this, is the 247 Sports team football recruiting rankings. This says it was last updated today at 3:46 Central, so that appears to be after this kid's commitment. K-State is now 43rd nationally, 8th in the Big 12.
Yeah, they were 48th coming into this by 24/7's numbers, so at least what they flash on the screen. That may have been CBS. That was CBS HQ was doing the thing. And now, so I'm not sure what numbers they use.
And I do caution people. At one point, like Texas Tech was number two in the country.
Yeah.
These things move.
These things change very rapidly.
Because you need – it's the formulas they use are the number of commitments and all this stuff, and there are many places who there are lots of players that haven't committed yet. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I've just seen some things running around some of the social media. Like, look at these Big 12 schools. Texas Tech, I'm going to tell you right now, is not going to finish number two.
Well, for me, the biggest thing, and Curtis noted this, that and I'm speaking, obviously, as a fan of a lesser football program, but when you are, unless you're one of the big boys in any sport, what I always like to do when a team gets a commit who else was recruiting them? Because you could say, oh, there's three stars next to him, three stars. Well, who else was recruiting him? Well, Army and Old Dominion. That's not necessarily a great land, but as Curtis noted, you're getting this guy over Oregon and Washington, and those were just the finalists. Those weren't just the teams that had interest.
Yeah. Right.
So as Curtis noted, not only is this kid highly rated, they also won this commitment over some good programs.
Yeah, I have him at 6 of the top 12 in the state of Kansas have committed to K-State this year. That's big. As I said, John Randall Jr., he's number 2, not committed. It's a tight end out of Eudora going to Arkansas. There's a kid going to Notre Dame out of Topeka, kid going to Baylor. So there's some places there. Some guys going to other places. And there's a few undecided guys. But so far, so good for K-State in-state. Big commits the last couple of weeks. But Dylan Edwards from Derby and Avery Johnson from Mays. So those are important things to do when you're trying to get through that. It's a big stretch here for Chris Klieman. You know, you want to continue to show improvement. They made the bowl last year. They want to keep going and kind of assert that as it goes. Last year, just for reference, of all the top 8 commitments, they all went out of the state of Kansas till you got down to number 8 at K-State. So they're getting some in-state kids at Kansas this year.
All right, who was the first pitcher to have a 25-save season for 3 different teams? Brought to you by Joe's Kansas City Barbecue.